Please call the case.
Case number SCPW 1392, Cohen v. Ayade, arguing for the petitioner, James Krueger, also appearing for the petitioner, Lauren Tilley. Arguing for the respondent, Sydney Ayade, arguing on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Krueger and Mr. Tilley and Mr. Ayade. Are you all ready to proceed this morning with your arguments? All right. And my understanding, Mr. Krueger, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so there'll be a yellow warning light that'll come on with 10 minutes to go, and Mr. Ayade will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go as well. Mr. Krueger, please proceed.
We believe that the issues in this case are fairly clearly resolvable by reference to a combination of HIPAA, the Brenda case, and the Hawaii Constitution, Article 1, Section 6. The methodology of how this bad result came about is predicated upon two documents that were put out by the defense down below. One was an authorization for release of information, medical information that they wanted the plaintiff to sign. Another was a form of a protective order that they said had been a form that was adopted by the convention bar of this state. We told them at the time that I was unaware that that combination of this court or any other court or citizens of this community. Those two documents are appendices 5 and 7 to our petition. The basic problem that we deal with is that, and I will enumerate them singly when I talk about the protective order and the authorizations. The basic problem is that if these documents are allowed, they will allow the use Mr. Cohen's health information, which is otherwise protected, for two things. One, in matters unrelated to the lower court's proceeding, the tort proceeding, and or secondarily, within that proceeding, but for purposes not germane to the evaluation of plaintiff's tort claim. So, we believe that those documents violate Mr. Cohen's informational privacy rights under the Constitution. Let me talk about the protective order. The primary vice of the protective order is found in paragraph 1B, vis a vis. And one thing that we have to recognize is that the language in the effective order is found in its reference to quote unquote any claim arising out of the subject accident, as opposed to a claim arising out of the litigation for which the information is requested. Which is to say that unless the information which is sought is germane to an evaluation of the plaintiff's claim, frankly, it doesn't make any difference whether the claim itself is arising out of the underlying tort.
Mr. Krueger, I was focusing on that language as well because I saw that you raised it in your supplemental brief, but wasn't that language or similar language proposed by the plaintiff to Judge Ayade below? I think it was Appendix 6 to your petition. So that language there was in relation to any claim, litigation, and or proceeding arising out of the September 26, 2009 occurrence. So that same language had been proposed by the plaintiff. It appears, but if you can clarify that for me, that would be great.
No, it does appear that, and I confess to the court in the last 2 days I've had some of an epiphany in taking a look at this more closely.
But can we say that Judge Ayabe abused his discretion if that very language was presented to him by both sides?
Yes, because that's not controlling. Because the use restrictions, although there's some, I'm saying, are geographic, that there can be a bias if it's requested in the underlying tort case or extrinsic to it. I think the harm is that the information is being sought bluntly for insurance company purposes and their mechanics of operating their business as opposed to evaluating the plaintiff's claim. If we look at the protective order, subsection 1B has this very vice in sections 2, 6, and 8, and they talk about, in the language of the order, proposed, any claim or matter related to the subject accident. That's way too broad. That's not restricted to the evaluation of plaintiff's claim. Number 6 talks about reporting to governmental health or medical insurance organizations or their private contractors. That doesn't talk about in or out of the underlying litigation, and it certainly doesn't talk about an evaluation of the plaintiff's medical condition. Subsection 8, for any record-keeping requirements or obligations relating to any of the foregoing and pertaining to the subject accident, but no reference to the plaintiff's injuries, her medical or his medical condition. That's the vice. There's no causal relationship between them. And if you look at section B3, it's for external review and auditing, such as by reinsurers, the insurance commissioner, or external auditors. No reference whatsoever to being involved in the underlying case or extrinsic to it.
But is not the insurance commissioner the regulatory body responsible for reviewing insurers in the state? Is it the plaintiff's position that the regulatory entity responsible for regulating these insurance companies couldn't have access to that information?
I think that they would have to acquire it in a different manner than an authorization from the plaintiff or some agreement by the plaintiff where he or she is going to give up her constitutional rights. I don't think you can be forced to sign a document. I know of no law in this jurisdiction, statute, or case law that says an average person who's involved in a tort suit has to be, and I'll talk about this in the area of the authorization on the redisclosure issues, where it says that you can be losing your federal protection rights if you sign that document.
But I know couldn't that frustrate the purpose of the regulation or the regulatory entities' efforts to ensure the safety and soundness of insurers if every element of every claim where there's information that's been provided in this manner, they would have to go independently seek an authorization for? You understand where it's the entity responsible for regulating insurers. Would that not frustrate their regulatory powers?
I think on balance, the rights of the people under the Constitution and under the federal law is superior.
Well, this document only pertains to the parties, I suppose, or I guess their allies.
I think so, Judge, because it has to relate to the evaluation of the plaintiff's medical injuries under the tort claim.
So there may be other statutes which would control access to records through by regulators.
If not access to the courts, yes.
Does the federal CFR expressly allow this information from being used outside of the litigation?
only under certain circumstances where there have been certain documentations that have the controls that we seek and were approved by a court.
Isn't one of those requirements when you transfer the information to another entity and they're considered a business associate under the federal regulations, there are extensive requirements for transferring information to business associates. Is that correct?
I don't know that. I haven't come across that in the cases that we've cited. I haven't come across that in your previous decision. I haven't come across that in the CFR that's applicable in this case. That may not be brought up if I may invest it. There is...
Mr. Kruger, the defense raises the question of whether or not you timely appealed from the, I guess it's July 3rd order,
yes,
requiring you to sign off on the order and the authorization. And I think they also indicate you failed to timely appeal from the administrator's decision to the administrative judge.
Let me address that. We take the position of the July 3 message, if you will, from the arbitrator was not a real order, that the real order is her decision of September 7th. There were, after July 3, continuing modifications, attempted modifications. The defense was sending more authorizations over. We were telling the arbitrator that this isn't something we can agree to. We had another we had two more pretrial conferences, pre-hearing conferences on the 20th of August, and on the 27th of August, the defense asked for a pre-conference, pre-hearing conference, and an order. And it was from that date that arbitrator Nason issued her actual order, the only one that's been filed in this court that is in the form of an order. Anything before that would take the position that was not being ordered in any kind of final nature or kind, did not address the issues, and just said he gave us what she thought, but didn't say with the fall of the gavel that was an order. Secondly, when we look at the September 18th date of our appeal to the administrator, it should be reflected that there were two weekends within that period of time. And when we look at the rule about we get two extra days when we're serviced by mail, I think that we were timely in that regard. Subsection 1B4 has the same vice, except it refers to subrogation. Now, I would find it very difficult to understand how the insurance company's subrogation and reimbursement issues arising out of a subject accident have anything to do with my client's medical history claim or the need for my client to sign a document that gives up his or her rights just because it may affect the right of the insurance company to have subrogation. So the last problem, and I think it's
was B4, I'm sorry, B4 in the defendant's order, you're challenging that one?
Yes.
Okay, and maybe I mistook, but I thought that there was, again, similar language in your proposed order for subrogation and reimbursement matters concerning the subject occurrence, such as I thought there was similar language.
You are absolutely correct. You're wrong.
So your position would be that despite that your position below, that the trial court was obligated to apply the HIPAA law independent of any arguments that the parties might have made below.
Lastly, in the procedural issues with the protective order, we should take a look at paragraph 5. This has to do with the return of documents that are obtained. So if there are medical data that are secured by the defense and their cronies, then when the case is resolved, the general rule is, according to HIPAA, that you have to return them or file a certificate that you destroyed them. Now, how or why this paragraph was written as it was, but the first paragraph of it talks about the defendant, respondent, his or her counsel's option, shall return to plaintiff's claimant the records or destroy the information. So that's about the lawyer's conduct. The second paragraph then says, under circumstances where they don't have to return the information that they received. This doesn't apply to health information retained by insurance companies, law firms. You've got one paragraph that says the law firm has to return it. They got a second paragraph saying the law firm doesn't have to return it. I don't know that we can live with that kind of ambiguity. In any regard, those are the vices of the protective order, the vices with respect to the authorizations. We must keep in mind that an authorization is no more than a request for a release of documents made by the patient to the medical care provider. It is not and cannot be and was never intended to be a document crafted to include the constitutional or federal privacy rights. And so if we don't have a protective order in place, a bare authorization, even if it's with a subpoena, we are going to say to this court, it's unusable. We're saying to this court that there ought to be a ruling hereafter that in tort litigation in Hawaii, the use of an authorization per se, even with a subpoena, doesn't meet federal and state criteria for privacy rights.
Is it your position that those rights are not waivable?
I think if we're going to talk about waiver, we need to talk about knowing waivers, informed consent type issues, and somewhere.
Well, represented by able counsel such as yourselves, presumably the plaintiff would be well advised about what rights they do or don't have. And I guess my question is, if we're going to say that the judge below should have enforced HIPAA, even though the parties were coming before him and presenting language that varied or went a little bit farther than HIPAA would restrict the disclosure of, are we saying the judge has to reject, even if the two parties want to agree or provide some flexibility in some area, the judge has to reject that?
I can't say what a judge ought to do. Right?
Well, I guess I'm trying to understand. In other words,
I have the temerity to say that if I were the judge and I had to rule on whether the parties were co-committing an erroneous act, I wouldn't let him do it.
So in other words, if during the course of the litigation you decided that there was some give, that it was in your client's interest to perhaps allow the reinsurer, allow an auditor to give in exchange for some other concession that was offered by the defense, where perhaps they would go even farther than HIPAA, that the judge should step in and say, I'm not going to allow that?
I think under those circumstances, counsel would have the right to advise his client appropriately.
I mean, the judge, the counsel could tell their client that they should, that they
you
can waive.
You may wish under the circumstances for reasons not germane to the particular issue of privacy, but for other reasons, maybe they want to settle the case or whatever, that it's in your best interest to waive it.
But that would have to be expressed on the record. Again, I'm trying to understand, you know, from Judge Ayabe's point of view, if he had language presented to him where both sides are advocating for a particular provision that goes beyond what HIPAA might allow, under what circumstances should it be brought to his attention that that's a knowing waiver?
I think that usually would wind up, as HIPAA does talk about, where there are circumstances where HIPAA isn't going to be followed, that it has to be the result of a court order as well.
So brought to the attention of the judge.
Did you ever indicate your intention to sign the authorization?
Did I ever?
On behalf of your client to either the arbitrator or anybody else, that you wanted to waive your rights under this authorization that had been proposed?
Okay, so I'm clear. Did I ever talk to my client about whether he wants to waive his rights?
No. Did you ever take a position in the proceedings that you were willing to sign this authorization?
No.
And that authorization, how do you interpret its implications?
I interpret the authorization as one which can result in a forced waiver of the client's rights because of the redisclosure circumstance that is uncontrolled. Nobody should be required to sign a document which would result in a redisclosure that's not controllable and which, as the document says, if you sign this, you can lose your federal privacy rights. Well, at the cost of having a tort suit, that's not fair. It's not fair to the client to put the client to that circumstance. So we say that that's a forced waiver that should not be imposed on the client.
Separate and apart of whether or not you can waive the rights in trial court, why shouldn't we consider a waiver of the point of issue on appeal if you submitted the same form as Mr. Young?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Why shouldn't we consider a waiver of the argument if you had submitted the same form as Mr. Ayami, the argument on rent?
I'm sorry, Judge, I'm not tracking you.
Well, I think the CJ was talking about whether you could waive your privacy rights. Your client could waive the privacy rights. But looking at the appellate procedure, if you submitted the same form as Mr. Ayami for the SQPO, why haven't you waived it for the writ, the issue?
Well, you don't waive it because it's not something that's happened.
Waive the issue.
The issue of waiver doesn't come up unless the document is signed.
Right. Well, I think the problem here is that this is not an appeal. This is a writ of mandamus which we have to review whether the trial judge committed a clear and manifest abuse of discretion. And so I think the questions are directed toward the issue of how can this court find a clear and manifest abuse of discretion if plaintiff's counsel submitted certain language that was identical to the protective order submitted by the defense. I realize that there may be other issues that there was no identical language. But for the portions that were identical, how can this court find a clear and manifest abuse of discretion of the trial judge?
That's a fair question. And so to the extent that there are other issues that would still carry the day, so to speak, I would concede those would be the appropriate ones to follow.
Okay, thank you.
My time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kruger. We'll hear from Mr. Ayabi at this point.
Good morning. May I please the court?
Good morning.
First, I'd like to address briefly on the timeliness. According to the petitioner, they take the position that it was timely filed and the so-called order, there was no such order. But if one look at the Cornet Court Annex Arbitration Program arbitrator in its September 7, 2012 order, it does make reference to the July 3, 2012 as an order. On page 10 of our submission, this is what was in the September 7, 2012 order by the arbitrator. Plaintiff had previously requested that defendants herein sign a stipulated qualified protective order prepared by plaintiff's counsel. A prior further pre-hearing conference was conducted on June 26, 2012 to resolve the parties' disagreement regarding the form of a SQPO. A written order was issued by the arbitrator dated July 3, 2012, which provided that the form of SQPO to be utilized in this case will be the form that appears on the Hawaii State Bar Association website. By email dated July 6, 2012, plaintiff counsel notified defendants herein that they would not be signing the SQPO, contrary to the order issued by the arbitrator. So I would take exception to the remark by counsel, indicating that there was, in fact, no outstanding order as of July 3, 2012. And if, in fact, you look at the July 3, 2012 as an order, as so indicated by the CAP arbitrator, then There should have been a timely appeal filed by July 10th, 2012, but there was never an appeal taken on the July 3, 2012 order issued by the CAP arbitrator.
But there was a timely appeal taken from the September 7th order, isn't that correct?
It was taken on September 18, 11 days later. Yes, there was an appeal taken on the September 7th, but filed on September 18th, a day later than the 10-day requirement. So our position is the order that should have been appealed from was the July 3, 2012 order, not the September 7th, 2012. And as so indicated by the CAP arbitrator, she looked at the July 3, 2012 order as an order where an appeal should have been timely filed on or before July 10th, 2012.
Didn't the arbitrator, administrator, and Judge Iabe go to the merits? They didn't rule on the timeliness issue, correct?
No, they did not. You are absolutely correct. And going for going towards the discussion regarding the privacy rights, the petitioner complains that, according to the SQPO, that is the subject matter of this controversy before this court.
Mr. Iabe,
yes?
If on this occasion the standard is clear and manifest, I guess, error, and that precludes the plaintiff then from raising the issue, and presumably plaintiff would not be foreclosed from raising the issue on appeal. In the interim, if in fact confidential health information that should not have been disclosed is disclosed, does that mean that this court should rule on the merits at this point? Because as we said in Bren, once you allow that information out, it cannot be undone. So if in fact, despite the plaintiff's position, Judge Iabe was wrong as a matter of law, shouldn't we decide the issue now? Sorry, didn't matter, two questions.
I agree that perhaps the issue should be decided. I guess my position would be that the issue has already been decided. There was a conference among plaintiffs and defense bar where a form of the order was arrived at, and subsequent to arriving at the form of the order, that matter was then submitted to the court for its input, and thereafter the form of the SQPO was arrived at by what we would refer to as a bench bar agreement, and it was put on the website, and the form of the order is the form of the SQPO is the order that was agreed to by the bench bar, and that was in 2008, a year following the Brenda versus Hara case. So if the court is asking me, well, should the court now address itself and look at this matter and make a decision as to the former of the SQPO, granted the fact that the bench bar had agreed to a form of the order, it's not binding on this court to say we are compelled to follow that proposed order that was agreed to. But certainly there's compelling reasons to look at it, since it was agreed to by the bench bar and it did follow the Brenda v. Hara case. So for that reason, I would question the need for this court to have to address that issue. And when you look at the Brenda versus Hara case, it does allow for record keeping, information gathering, and maintenance. So that, at the end of the Brenda versus Hara decision, this court did allow the rights of an insurance company to proceed in information gathering, collection of information, maintenance, and seeking medical records from a claimant who has put his health in controversy.
Mr. Iabe, would you agree that if, for whatever reason, the agreed-upon order provides lesser protections than HIPAA, that when presented with an objection to that order, that the court should, at a minimum, provide the protections that HIPAA would provide?
I have to I take exception to the court's position because I believe the SQPO, as submitted before this court, does comply with the HIPAA requirements. I believe in the request by this court for the supplemental brief, we tracked the five items that were complained about by the petitioner. That's 1B2, 1B3, 1B6, 1B7, and 1B8 in the SQPO. And in our supplemental submission, we tracked the federal regulations, HIPAA federal regulations, which provides the basis upon which these provisions are set forth in the SQPO. For example, we take paragraph 1B2 of SQPO, and the objections made by the petitioner is where it starts with relating to the review and slash or audit of claims for the purpose of setting premiums, etc. If you look at 45 CFR section 164.51, it does define healthcare operations to include business management and general administrative activities, including the provisions of data analysis for policyholders. It further states it also allows insurance companies to conduct or arrange for medical review, legal services, and auditing functions as part of their healthcare operations. We go to...
Of course, it applies to subject accidents, which is broader than the definition that HIPAA allows.
I beg your pardon?
The provision that you just read,
yeah.
The federal language, the language that your stipulation has, applies it to subject accident, which is defined broader. And I understand that the petitioner, their proposal had similar language, but the nature of subject accident is defined broader than the HIPAA regulation.
I'm not sure it really provides a broader definition. I believe the manner in which the federal regulations, as well as the SQPO that is submitted, comports with the federal regulations. I'm not sure if it expands it to make it broader, because it relates to the subject occurrence, which of course would relate to the subject accident.
Well, the federal language says for any purpose, it's limited to for any purpose other than the litigation or proceeding for which such information was requested, versus your language in relation to any claim, litigation, or proceeding arising out of the accident. So it can apply to other litigation, nothing to do with the very litigation that underlies this case.
Right, but the purpose of why it's saying that is because of auditing purpose, and that's the reason why you look at it as an expansive nature, but it is limited and is provided by 45 CFR 164.50 to allow them to do the auditing function. So I don't believe that provides a more expansive allowance on the part of the insurance carrier.
Are there protections to ensure that the auditors or other individuals who might come in possession of this information are required to adhere to the same terms of the protective order? And is that an issue that needs to be addressed in some of these areas where third-party possession of the information is anticipated?
I believe there are safeguards in place that would preclude them to disseminate this to the public, and I don't believe that type of conduct would take place where it's purely for auditing purposes or as far as the insurance commissioner. The insurance commissioner requires the insurance carrier to provide information which they have obtained from a particular claimant for whatever reason, and primarily the, one of the factors where there would be a requirement by the insurance commission if in fact there is an allegation of fraud committed on the part of a claimant. And in that situation, I don't believe the carrier would have any basis to preclude the insurance commissioner from requiring the insurance carrier to provide such requirement. And that's allowed in the HIPAA regulation where it says a covered entity may use or disclose protected health information to the extent that such use or disclosure is required by law. That's 45 CFR 164.5.
If it's required by law, then it's not necessary for that that be included in the order according to HIPAA, would it?
I beg your pardon?
If it was required by law, then we wouldn't need to refer to that in the order.
But he objected to that. The petition did object to that language.
Well, what I'm saying, I guess, is we don't need it. If it's required by law, then, you know, we don't need it. But if we excise the provisions relating to disclosure or redisclosure, would that have any impact on your ability to defend in this case?
Well, if you, based on my response, would be no, it would not.
You know, in footnote 6, you made mention of the fact that Brandy allows the collateral functions like record keeping, maintenance, collection, etc. I think I read footnote 6 a little differently, because footnote 6 states that pursuant to provision 3.A3, and then quotes, I guess, from the existing protective order, but then says the qualified protective order as revised, revision meaning what the court held in Brandy, would be subject to modification by the circuit court upon respondent showing of a need outside of the underlying litigation for petitioner's health information produced in discovery that outweighs the harm resulting from disclosure of such information outside of the litigation. I read that to mean that Brandy said it does not approve per se of these functions of collection and record keeping unless there's a showing that disclosure of the information would outweigh the harm resulting from disclosure. Do you read it that way too?
Well, I don't read it quite the same way as you do. I look at that they do allow the insurance carrier to have the requirements of their practices of having record keeping, maintenance, information gathering, and that would be part and parcel. What you would basically do would be would put a very onerous requirement on the carrier in order for them to determine rate making, to determine whether there's any fraud type of conduct, things of that nature. Every time there is a claim, then they would need to go to court to say we would want to have the right to do information collection, to have auditors review this. So basically, it would limit the information gathered by the defense only to the insurance defense attorney and to the claims representative. But the insurance carrier as a whole, the industry, would not be able to review the types of claims, the exposure involved, and make a decision as to what would be the policy for rates to be applied in the future. That would be taken away from them. So there's no way for them to evaluate each case and determine what would be the rate-making policy for subsequent years.
Aren't there two alternatives in that? First of all, you can de-identify the information. That means strip it totally so it's not covered by HIPAA if you follow the very, very strict regulations on stripping all identifiers from the information. And the second alternative you have is if these other reinsurers or these other companies need to look at the information, the federal regulations have specific regulations as to the types of contracts that you have to enter into that protects the information.
Well, the regulation does say that you would de-identify, and that's part and parcel of the SQPO that we have. We have recognized that.
But it doesn't go, it's not consistent with the requirements. It doesn't go far enough. The federal regulations are much more comprehensive.
Well, I think the when you say the federal regulation go far more and are more extensive, I looked at the federal regulations and looking at the requirements imposed by federal regulations and
Don't the federal regulations go farther? The order says name, street address, birth date, social security number, and driver's license number. The federal regulations, telephone numbers, fax numbers, electronic mail addresses, medical record numbers, health plan beneficiary numbers, account numbers, certificate license numbers, vehicle identifiers, device identifiers, I'm not sure what that is, but web URLs, biometric identifiers, full-face photographic images, and any comparable images. So the federal reg has a very, very long list, and that's in the CFR 164.514B2, has this very long list, which is a longer list than what the protective order says needs to be scrubbed.
And I agree with you, but I believe the protective order does provide the protection, and I don't see the reasons for having to set for all of the requirements as noted in the federal regulations. But you are correct, it has a whole laundry list of items that they have contained within it. The SQPO does not have that laundry list, but I believe the SQPO does provide the protection to the individual's right of privacy. And what? Also, when you look at the SQPO, it does, when there's an objection to 1B8, record-keeping requirements. In that particular requirement, it does say that plaintiff shall not unreasonably withhold consent. If he does, of course, the matter then would require the requesting party to go to court to see whether the withholding of that consent by the individual is reasonable or not. So
that's a provision that Mr. Krueger objected to. What would be the basis for requiring the plaintiff to agree to that provision? What basis in law is there for requiring the plaintiff in advance to agree to not unreasonably withhold consent, provided that additional categories are consistent?
The reason for that particular category is to allow in the event there's additional information that's requested in their investigation, that record keeping, maintenance, policy holder, rate making, policy decision making practices. And then I would agree it's a catch-all type provision, but there's still the protection that they cannot obtain additional information unless they first make the request as to why they need additional information, and two, there has to be consent provided. So there's a safety mechanism. It is a catch-all provision. I agree with the court, but at the same time, it's not where the party who's being requested of the additional information or any type of waiver has to automatically provide it. He can say, no, I'm withholding my consent, and the matter will be presented to the court for determination.
Mr. Ayabe,
yes.
I seem to be stuck on the procedural issue, but do you think this should have been brought as a different type of writ rather than a writ of mandamus? And if so, do you think that Are you aware of any cases in which this court has treated something that is brought as one writ as a different type of writ?
Yeah, I was first surprised that the court entertained the writ. I would say that. Certainly, I don't think it was appropriate for the matter to be brought to this court because of the timeliness. I just felt that when we talk about procedure, then I would go back to the fact that procedure, it should not have been granted a writ because of the timeliness. And of course, writ of mandate is an extraordinary request for a remedy to be made, and I don't believe the requirements have been met for a number of reasons that has been already discussed with the court.
Mr. Abbey, could you address the authorization? Mr. Krueger, I think, challenged a portion of that authorization that reads, I understand the health information released under this authorization may be redisclosed by the recipient in relation to the case matter for which this authorization is provided and may no longer be protected under the federal privacy regulations. As I understand Mr. Krueger's argument, he views that as potentially being interpreted as a waiver of protection by the plaintiff that the plaintiff should not be required to make. What is your response to that argument?
On that authorization, I think in reviewing the matter before presenting argument today, probably with the SQPO in place, there probably is no need for a written provides a protection to the individual, protecting his rights of privacy. The written authorization, I don't want to concede, but I would say it does not provide the protection that the SQPO provides to that individual.
So don't need it at all, or don't need that language in it?
Actually, if we have the SQPO as presented, there probably is no need for the written authorization.
Because will the medical record holders produce the records in response to the qualified protective order?
They should. They should with the SQPO.
You agree with Brendy that HIPAA is only the federal floor for privacy?
I agree with you.
So that HIPAA in and of itself is not necessarily relevant in Hawaii, if we accept Brendy's pronouncement that what controls would be Article 1, Section 6 of the Hawaii Constitution.
I agree.
So Article 1, Section 6 of the Hawaii Constitution sets a stricter standard, doesn't it, for disclosure of privacy information?
Well, it sets forth that there has to be compelling state interest before one's privacy right would be given up. I acknowledge that. But viewing the Brandy versus Howard decision in light of the SGPO and in light of the rules and regulations set forth under the HIPAA law, I believe the SGPO provides the protection as required or enunciated in the Brandy case, the Brenda case.
Any insurance company coming into Hawaii would recognize that, at least within the borders of the state, the Hawaii Constitution would control based even on the federal regulation, which says that if there are more stringent privacy protections in place, those would control rather than HIPAA.
Well, I would just respond by saying, let's hope they do. I would assume that they would recognize the fact that there is that outstanding decision within the versus Hara that has indicated that Article 1, Section 6 does provide protection, and the federal rules and regulations sets the floor, and the state, pursuant to that case law, can require more stringent requirements in order to protect the privacy rights of an individual. I have nothing further to add but to say that I would request that the writ of mandamus be denied. I believe the SQPO does satisfy not only Article 1, Section 6 of the Hawaii State Constitution, but also the HIPAA requirements as set forth under 45 CFR 164. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abbey. Mr. Kruger, your rebuttal.
Mr. Kruger, you know, my thought is that Brandy really controls and settles this case, because Brandy recognized the existence of HIPAA, recognized that HIPAA created the federal floor, as the federal government itself does, and that the informational right of privacy in the Hawaii Constitution would establish a higher threshold in terms of disclosure of private information. What's your position on that?
I thought I'd mention, I thought HIPAA, our Constitution, and Brendan taken as a whole would control this proceeding.
In fact, doesn't the holding in Brendy say that, and I'm reading somewhat out of context, but there's no present legitimate need for disclosure of petitioner's health information unrelated to the underlying litigation, and disclosure outside the litigation of petitioner's health information produced in discovery will violate petitioner's informational privacy right under Article 1, Section 6. So doesn't Randy say privacy information can be disclosed within the litigation itself, but because of Article 1, Section 6, not outside of the litigation.
Yes, sir.
And in that sense, footnote 6 becomes very clear, because footnote 6 says, well, your present order says you can use the information for record keeping, et cetera, but we've revised that order, and if you want to include those matters in the order, then you have to show that the information outweighs the harm that would result from the disclosure. So doesn't Brandy establish a clear line? Stuff within the litigation, that can be disclosed. Stuff outside of the litigation, i.e. disclosure to whoever, auditing to whoever, auditing by whoever, that stuff can only be disclosed if you go through the process of showing that the production outweighs, or the reason for producing it would outweigh the harm that is presumed by disclosure of that information.
That's the reason we took the position we did from the beginning, and we expected that the other side would have then gone to court to secure via motion if it had a legitimate need that information. As opposed
to, and in this case has been, let me change that. So if that's the law, and by his order, Judge Ayabe, whether you folks may have misled him or not, violated that law, would that be a clear and manifest abuse of discretion?
Yes.
And if once that information would be allowed and could not, as Brandy says, be undone, then would there be any other remedy available to you?
With all due respect to Judge Ayabe, the vices of the protective order, the vices of the authorizations are clear on their face. They're not interpreted. And so whatever was available to him in that regard, a clear reading of those two documents would tell you that they fly in the face of the guarantees that Brandy has said. I wrote down, as Mr. Ayabe was speaking, there is no other remedy. We can't, these discovery orders by law are not appealable. And once, as Judge, as CJ just said, once that information is out, the cat's out of the bag. And we can't put it back in. So this is, with all due respect to Judge McKenna, I do think this is a proper venue, the proper procedure, and the court was correct in allowing this to come before you. The issue of rates being affected, if it were only the plaintiff's rates that he or she would be charged for making a claim, that's one thing. But there's no showing how the industry is going to be benefited by getting one person's medical information and setting rates for everybody in the community. That's a real stretch, in my opinion. So I come back to the point that on the authorizations, they can't be used. It's a different day, pre-HIPAA. Those days are gone. They should be gone. You get the protective order in place. You get a subpoena with the Rule 31, and there's no question. All rights are preserved. I have nothing further.
Thank you very much to both of our counsel here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.